Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, part-time wanderer.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that mourns the artistic losses that have occurred in these first few months of 2025. The list includes everyone from Blondie drummer Clem Burke to former world champion heavyweight George Foreman, one-time Gossip Girl Michelle Trachtenberg, to the man who played both Jim Morrison and Doc Holliday, Val Kilmer. Amid these and other passings, two stand out to the three of us: the director David Lynch and the two-time Oscar-winning actor Gene Hackman. As such, we thought we'd devote this entire show to running down what we consider to be the best of what each had to offer over the course of their careers, which, not to overstate things, is a wealth of riches. Let's begin with Lynch. Born on January 20, 1946, Lynch died just short of his 79th birthday this past January 16th. A native of Missoula, he moved with his family around the country following the jobs taken by his research scientist father. He even lived for a time in Spokane, which explains a lot, actually. After studying to be a painter, he began making films in 1967, his first titled Six Men Getting Sick Six Times, which he described as, quote, 57 seconds of growth and fire and 3 seconds of vomit, unquote. Eventually, he ended up in Los Angeles and, working at the American Film Institute, he made the film that earned him his first fame, Eraserhead. From there, he bounced back and forth between more mainstream projects, The Elephant Man, say, and his 1984 adaptation of Dune, but his best work was, and remains, mainly those of his own, some would say twisted personal vision. 1986's Blue Velvet, his 1989-1991 television series Twin Peaks, and his 2001 masterpiece, Mulholland Drive.
Well, I've been thinking about this since he passed away, because David Lynch means a lot to me, about why his work has lasted, why he, when he passed away, it seemed like everybody was offering up eulogies to David Lynch and why he was important. And I think it's because he was, over the course of his career, so obstinately and defiantly himself.
Exactly.
And he devoted his TV and film career in particular to stories that obviously meant something to him, and sometimes perhaps only to him. His movies sometimes seem just locked in his brain, and he refused to explain some of the more mysterious things in his work. And I don't think he ever made things to appease audiences. I mean, he made things that occasionally aligned with mainstream tastes.
Straight story.
Sure. I mean, even Twin Peaks, which was a phenomenon for a while. But I think he made stuff that just came from somewhere deep in his psyche, and he just had to get them out. And he never softened his vision to make it more palatable or universal. And I think when you make art like that, when you devote your life to making art like that, art that is so deeply personal and distinct, it's not going to connect with everyone, but for those it does connect with, it connects in a profound way. And what I love about David Lynch's work is that it doesn't explain itself. It doesn't define itself. And every time I revisit something like Mulholland Drive or Blue Velvet or Eraserhead, they feel like they've been shape-shifting while I haven't been looking at them. Like, they're a little bit different from the last time I watched them. And that's why they're like recurring dreams. And I think that's another reason that they endure, is that they refuse to settle down. They refuse to be defined. And and so he was ahead of his time in a lot of ways.
One of the things you say there is that his films refuse to define themselves, to explain themselves to us. And that's the nature of all really good art. But in the sense of that, in his best films, and Mulholland Drive, for me, is his masterpiece, it doesn't have to explain itself because it's all there on the screen. It's the experience. I remember when that film was over, I was sitting next to Mary Pat, and we just sat there stunned. I remember somebody walking by going, well, what was that about? And I went, well, it's not going to speak to everybody. And not all of his films did work. I Lost Highway, to me, was too creepy with Robert Blake. Wild at Heart, Nicolas Cage was just too weird.
I loved that movie.
I mean, yes, okay, but to me, it was an effective film, but I didn't think that it was
Nicolas
necessarily.
But with Nicolas Cage, Laura Dern, and Willem Dafoe, I mean, you know, how could you go wrong? I guess my recollection of David Lynch, I mean, I saw Eraserhead, and I was in school at the time, and we sort of saw it on a lark, and it was a midnight screening, and I came out, and we were all like, what was that? But then this is where I got pulled off center, because right after, or shortly shortly after that. Then he makes Elephant Man and Dune. And yeah. I was like, okay, so where is this guy coming from? And then all of a sudden, then we're back to Blue Velvet, Twin Peaks, mm-hmm. you know.
But
and
that's when he, Mel Brooks saw him and immediately said, this guy has talent. He spotted him and wanted him to do these other films, Elephant Man in particular.
And let's not
and
forget
And so he got he, off track.
Well, and The Elephant Man, I think, is a great movie. I will defend his Dune as well as a gonzo, you know, failure, whatever you want to call it. Let's not forget that he was almost tapped to direct Return of the Jedi as well, because yeah. he was like the director of the moment. Mm-hmm. Mulholland Drive was, I'm pretty sure, was the first Lynch movie I saw and also didn't know what to make of it. But there was something about it that just entranced me. And
Naomi Watts' performance.
One
is,
of the best performances
absolutely.
Ever. And the thing about Mulholland Drive, and I think it speaks to all of Lynch's work, especially his more mysterious work, is that the first time I saw it, I was obsessed with trying to solve it. What exactly is going on here? Who's who and what's what? And I think I have a pretty good handle on ultimately what it's quote unquote about. But I also don't think that that's the point. And I don't think that's why that movie has lasted. And the Sight and Sound poll that came out most recently, it was in the top 10 films of all Great. Time voted by critics and filmmakers. And I think it's because, like I said, it just continues on, but everyone comes at it from a different angle.
Yeah.
You bring something new to it every time you see it, and you come away with something different every yeah. time you see it.
I was talking to Mary Pat about this, and I was saying, to me, judging Lynch is like judging much of modern art. And for an example, let's talk about Jackson Pollock. Jackson Pollock, if you look at his works in the late 40s going up into the early 50s, and then later in the late 50s up until right around the time he died, he was working to a point, working to get his vision on screen, and he does it. If you go to the MoMA, to this day, every time we go to the Museum of Modern Art, Dan runs up there. I have to see Number One, and it's just this huge thing, and it's his drip painting, but it's magnificent, and you can see his stumbling efforts to get to that and his stumbling efforts afterward. And I think that's the same with Lynch. He's going back and forth. There's something to recommend every single one of his movies, but it's Mulholland Drive, which is his masterpiece.
Well, and I think we need to talk just briefly, at least, about Twin Peaks. But when I went back and sort of checked things out, I was like surprised. He was nominated for Best Director 3 times, mm-hmm. and he never won.
Yeah.
He never won. Yeah. And that, to me, is shocking. I mean,
well, the Academy never embraced his movies. You know, he was nominated for Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive, and those are the only nominations those movies
And Elephant got. Man, right?
Yeah, but that got nominated for other
Correct.
Things.
And yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like the director's branch appreciated what he was doing and the rest of the Academy. It was like that person walking past you saying, what was that all about? The thing that I wanted to talk about with Lynch, because I've been revisiting a lot of his work, and maybe we'll talk about Wild at Heart at the end, but I think one of the mistakes that I think his detractors make is that his style or his approach was a put-on. I think David Lynch is one of the most deeply sincere filmmakers to ever be mistaken for an ironist. You look at Roger Ebert's reviews of David Lynch's early work, which are some of his worst and most misguided reviews.
Yeah, he didn't know what to make of him.
And he's mad because he feels like Lynch is trafficking in these unsavory subjects and not taking them seriously. He feels like everything's always a joke to David Lynch. And I think that Lynch's best movies are about purity in all of its different forms. It's usually about how purity is defiled in the case of something like Lost Highway or Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, but it's also about how purity and goodness can persist in spite of evil. And rewatching Blue Velvet a few months ago at the Magic Lantern, which Ebert really hated, if you recall, I had forgotten how genuinely heartfelt that movie is. I mean, it's horrifying and it's weirdly funny and it's disturbing and shocking sometimes at the same time. But that movie, you come away from it, I feel like it's about, this is going to sound corny, but it's about like the strength of the human spirit, because ultimately everyone comes out
well,
on the other
side. I think a lot of his movies are
better.
Like that.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that it was because he was blending all of these different genres and he left people unsure of how to feel. They just assumed that he was, you know, having a laugh.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's the case.
Given his personal foibles and that he made professional, How do we explain Twin Peaks, the television series, the popularity there?
Oh, well, I mean, I think it was the hook of the Who Killed Laura Palmer. It was the fact
that... A damn good cup of coffee and a piece of cherry pie.
And I think, you know, it was the fact that TV had never looked like that before.
And great music, you know, by Angela Badalamenti,
who also just recently passed away. And I think that Twin Peaks is such an incredible achievement. I think Fire Walk With Me is, people are coming around on that. It was misunderstood at the time. And Twin Peaks, The Return, which was the last major film work that David Lynch did, is also just a remarkable thing. And, you know, as soon as he passed away, I was like, I think I need to go back and watch Twin Peaks from episode one all the way through The Return, because it's just so good.
And that was our discussion of what made the late David Lynch great. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts and Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the career of another late screen talent, Gene Hackman. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed the career of the late great filmmaker David Lynch. Let's now turn to another recently passed film star, Gene Hackman. Born on January 30th, 1930, the two-time Oscar-winning actor Hackman died this past February 18th at the age of 95. Though the strange circumstances involving both his death and that of his wife Betsy Arakawa made headlines, a vast number of stories carried fond reminiscences of him passed on by those who had worked with him. Born in San Bernardino, California, he later moved with his family to the small Illinois city of Danville. After joining the Marines at age 16, lying about his age, he ended up moving back to California, where he began to live out his childhood dream of being an actor by joining the Pasadena Playhouse. Though he and fellow actor Dustin Hoffman didn't do well at the Playhouse, both of whom were voted least likely to succeed, they and fellow Californian Robert Duvall found themselves rooming together in New York City, struggling to make their names. Hackman worked on the stage, on television, and scored movie bit parts, his first uncredited appearance coming in the 1961 crime film Mad Dog Call. Hackman got his break when Arthur Penn cast him as Buck Barrow, the brother to Warren Beatty's Clyde Barrow, in 1967's Bonnie and Clyde. A Best Supporting Actor nomination followed, as did a career that included such highlights as 1971's The French Connection and 1992's Unforgiven, both of which won him Oscars.
I'm going to focus on a few of the Gene Hackman films that maybe others wouldn't necessarily shout out, but the diversity of his career is really amazing. So longevity, sure, but the diversity of types of films in which he appeared, I think, is really notable. So one of the things that I remembered him from, and this might sound bizarre, but the film Reds.
Oh, yeah.
So he was
another Warren Beatty,
right?
Thing,
exactly, yeah. And so he had this almost a cameo in that particular film. And I remember reading something recently about it, that Reds is a long 3-hour movie about the American communist movement or whatever. And so he has this like very sort of small part because he's a magazine editor. And he felt as though he had blown it. And he said, oh, you know, probably Warren Beatty, after being in Bonnie and Clyde, he had all these expectations, you know. And Beatty said afterwards, where'd he get that idea? He was great. It's exactly what I wanted. So that was one end of the spectrum, maybe, in terms of this long kind of fictionalized account of communism. But then I'm thinking of things such as Hoosiers. I mean, and I think if you like cheesy sports movies, this is one of the ones for you, sure.
And what's interesting, if you read the backstories of Hoosiers, he hated the movie. He hated the direction. He was absolutely certain that the movie was going to be a failure. He told Dennis Hopper, this is going to be the last movie you and I ever make. And afterwards, when he saw the film, he went to the director and he said, How did you guys do that? How did you, out of all the film footage that I saw, how did you make that movie? Because it is one of the great cheesy sports films.
And it's playing on Amazon Prime if you want to find it. So that was one of the ones that sort of stood out to me. Remember he was in The Birdcage?
Of course.
And that was great because here he is meeting the gay parents of the fiance, played by Robin Williams and Nathan Lane. And he wasn't the comedic performance, but yet he really was in many respects.
He's really funny in The Birdcage.
Yeah, he is. And then I'm thinking of things such as Mississippi Burning. That was another like sort of smaller film.
He had a special niche in which he could play a hard guy. Mississippi Burning was another one. It was almost like Spencer Tracy, you know, in that sense that he could come into a room.
Rod Steiger.
Exactly.
Like
I mean, he could own everything, but you need to talk about The Poseidon Adventure.
Me? Okay.
Yes.
Well, and I just want to preface this by saying that Gene Hackman is probably my favorite actor of all time, not only because of his presence, but because I just think that his performances were always stellar, even in movies that maybe didn't meet his talents. And he was famously not the easiest man to work with. There are lots of stories about that, including the one you shared about Hoosiers. And he was, you know, retired for almost two decades before his death. But I never saw him phone it in, even when it was very apparent that he maybe didn't even want to be in the movie that you were watching him in. And one of those would be 1972's film, The Poseidon Adventure. Now, Ben Stiller recently wrote an essay for The New York Times about working with Gene Hackman on The Royal Tenenbaums. And he says in this piece, you know, I finally got up the courage to talk to the guy because he was kind of irascible on set. You know, he gave Wes Anderson a hard time. And Ben Stiller tells Gene Hackman, you know, The Poseidon Adventure was a formative film for me. It made me want to make movies. And I know that you've done all these important works, but that's the one that means the most to me. And supposedly Gene Hackman took a second and then he looked at Ben Stiller and he said, a money job. He just took The Poseidon Adventure for the money. I'm sure it was a good paycheck because he had just won the Academy Award for The French Connection. And The Poseidon Adventure is a formative movie for me as well. I saw it when I was a little kid in the 90s, however, you know, 20 some years after Ben Stiller and everybody else would have seen it for the first time. And there was just something about that movie that hooked me as a kid. And you could draw a straight line from me watching The Poseidon Adventure to me sitting here talking to you right now. And in that movie, you know, and it's an ensemble disaster movie from the Irwin Allen film factory, Hackman plays a preacher who's on this ship, Reverend Frank Scott. And if you don't know the plot, the ocean liner is hit by a tidal wave, turns upside down. The survivors have to go from the bottom of the ship to the top, which have, you know, flip-flopped. And so he's leading this group of survivors through this series of obstacles, and they're dying one by one. And I think it's the greatest disaster movie because it has real stakes and it has real drama, because the movie makes it very clear early on that any of these characters could die at any moment. Even some of the biggest stars could go randomly.
Shelley Winters?
Roddy McDowell, for instance.
Red Spoiler, Buttons?
He makes it to the end, by the way. But what's fascinating about this character of Reverend Scott is that in this movie that's, you know, I'm sure a lot of people went to because it looked like a fun, dumb time at the cinema, he gets to have a really complicated kind of faith. And Hackman plays him as this man whose beliefs are being genuinely tested by the random violence that's all around him. And his final speech in the movie, I think, is genuinely powerful. And it makes a film that could have just been another expensive B movie, I guess, into, I think, a very powerful work of art. Scoff all you want to about my love of The Poseidon Adventure. Do I have a framed poster of the film in my home? Yes, I do.
Is it autographed?
It is not autographed.
Oh.
So I miss that. But it is a very important movie to me, and Gene Hackman's performance is one of the many reasons I love it so much.
You mentioned The Royal Tenenbaums. We could go on and we could talk about The Quick and the Dead. We could talk about Unforgiven. We could talk about No Way Out. We could talk about Downhill Racer. We could talk about
The French Connection.
The French Connection, exactly.
Oh, the
I want to talk about Young Frankenstein.
Sure.
Because he has absolutely
unrecognizable.
Like five minutes on screen,
yeah.
And he almost takes the movie away.
And that came out the same year he was in The Conversation. So what a year for
exactly. And his final lines as he's playing this blind guy who's trying to serve hot soup and light a cigar for the Frankenstein's monster played by Peter Boyle. And then finally the monster has just had enough and he runs out And his final line was apparently improvised. He goes, "Where are you going?"
I was
going to make espresso.
Sorry, I say that again. I stepped on it.
No, that's okay.
Well, okay. So to me, he will always be Popeye Doyle. I mean,
in the French Connection.
Yeah. And apparently Popeye's restaurant was named after them. Was that made up or I don't know. But
I kind of thought
just
it was
a little,
the comic character.
Just a little aside. Okay. But I think – and he got his first Oscar for this performance. And so he's the bad cop.
Eddie Egan.
Yeah. And I think that now we've seen more of those over the years. But, you know, I don't think any of these other sort of movies with that theme rise to the level of The French Connection. I mean, and the chase scene, you know, unforgettable.
Yeah, right.
Well, and I would say, you know, you talk about some of his comic turns. I mean, going back, I rewatched The Royal Tenenbaums at the Garland a few weeks ago. That's one of my all-time favorite movies. Another formative film. I saw that at just the right age where I had never seen a movie like that before. And I think, you know, Wes Anderson has never really written another character like Royal Tenenbaum, the character that Gene Hackman plays.
The patriarch.
But he's this wonderful agent of chaos. He is not the deadpan, perfectly tailored Wes Anderson archetype. He comes in and he's this whirling dervish that changes everybody's lives. And watching that movie just a few weeks ago, I thought, not only is this a perfect film, but it is a perfect performance from Gene Hackman.
Okay, so I think that we have to say The Conversation is my favorite. And so Coppola's story, 1974 film, but boy, this might be worth watching again. It's a film about surveillance. It's coming at the time of, you know, the end of the Vietnam War.
And it's such an understated performance.
Yes.
Right.
It might be, if I had to pick a favorite Gene Hackman performance, it would be as Harry Call in The Conversation, which I think is one of the greatest films of the 70s and of all time. So we've given you a lot of options for your watch list.
And
this
a lot
weekend.
Of those are available for streaming. Anyway, that was our discussion of the career of the late Gene Hackman. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbender, Mary Pat Truthart, and I did a similar look back at the career of the late film director David Lynch. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show. We thank you to our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from David Lynch himself. I learned that just beneath the surface, there's another world, and still different worlds as you dig deeper. There is goodness in blue skies and flowers, but another force, a wild pain and decay, also accompanies everything. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.